And in gratitude for that, and in respect of their work in so many different fields, this talk this evening will be a benefit for them. So whatever contributions you feel moved to make at the end of this talk, all those proceeds will go to support the work of Torvanar. I'd like to begin with a story. When I was, I think, probably 14 or 15 years old, and I remember it was at Christmas, I was staying with my mother and my brother in the house of my aunt and uncle in Chichester, on the south coast of England. And as one does often on those kinds of family occasions when one has little else to do, my mother and her sister had taken out an old photograph album, and they were leafing through it. I think, if I remember rightly, it was on the kitchen table. Many of the images were from their own childhood. And then they came to some pictures that had been taken during the Second World War. My mother was stationed for some time in North Africa. And I can't remember what I was doing, but I was in earshot of what they were saying to each other. And suddenly they came to a photograph of a man wearing military fatigues. I seem to remember he had a pipe in his mouth. No, I'm sorry, is this not? Is that better? Did you hear what I just said? Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, then we're going to have to move the mic. Is that okay? So everyone can see me and hear me. I saw a face just peer around. So no doubt you're waiting to see what happens next. My mother and her sister come to a photograph of a man in military fatigues, and I seem to remember he was smoking a pipe. And then my mother very casually said, in my direction, she said, "Oh, if things had worked out differently, he would have been your father." And I remember thinking to myself, if he had been my father, would I have been me? And I remember it made me feel very uncomfortable. It suddenly made me realize that I may not have existed. If instead of my actual father, my mother had married this man, or had an affair with this man, or whatever, and had her children with him, would I have ever existed? It troubled me, that, and it continues to be a recollection that somehow shocks my sense of self. It somehow unsettles the certainty that I feel about being me. If a different pair of cells had come together, another life would have been born. It wouldn't have been me. It might have been called Stephen, if my mother had had a particular longing to name her child that way. But genetically, it would have been someone else. even if, for example, with my actual father, my mother had conceived in her next ovarian cycle, would that person have been me? Or even closer to home, had a different spermatozoan of my father managed to make it to the ovum before the one that in fact did and ended up as me? Would that have been me? No, it would have been effectively a non-identical twin. Imagine, for example, as my two parents were passionately engaged in the act of sex, the one that was going to produce me. The telephone rang. And one of them, probably my father, would have gone and answered the phone. And when he came back, my mother would have said, "I'm not really in the mood anymore." Now, to them, that would have been a minor inconvenience. But for me, I wouldn't have existed. So, this sense we have of being who we are, this sense we have of self, is not quite as necessary as it seems. I have this funny feeling, and perhaps you share it too, that the world wouldn't quite be the world it is if I were not necessary to it. The world I know is the one that I know only through this sense of being who I am. And if I hadn't existed, would that have been? All these questions, as you might imagine, for a rather intellectually slightly precocious and neurotic young man, were very troubling. And in some ways, perhaps, that might have been the first inkling, the first sense of the questions that led me to Buddhism, which, as you're no doubt aware, is also rather curious about what, in fact, the self or the person is. Now, at the Buddha's time, there wouldn't have been such an understanding of the process of conception, for example, the understanding of how the genetic material and the chromosomes and so forth from my father's sperm and those in my mother's ovum combine to, and it's really absolutely extraordinary, that two such tiny specks fuse and then begin a process of development and gestation in a womb that give birth to a being, a little boy in my case, that eventually grows up into this creature who is convinced that, yes, I'm somehow necessary to things. I can't quite imagine the world without me in it. And actually, me not only in it, but actually right at the centre of it. The being around whom the world turns in an odd way. And it shows, I think, when we reflect in this way, that our existence is in many ways highly contingent. In other words, it need not have happened. We think things have to be the way they kind of are, but they need not have been. Any number of other potential scenarios could have unfolded. Another example. I think it was in 1921 when a man called Adolf Hitler launched his first attempt at a putsch. He and a bunch of collaborators marched on the Reichstag in Berlin. they joined arms and they walked down probably Unter den Linden towards the Reichstag. It was a totally kind of crackpot endeavor. And the police warned them not to approach any nearer. They refused, they kept on coming. And so the police opened fire. And one of those policemen, probably with a rifle, aiming at the demonstrators approaching, fired a shot. And it hit the man whose arm was linked to that of Hitler and killed him. Now, if that soldier's rifle had just been fractionally in a different alignment, if his colleague next to him had nudged him or something, that bullet would have struck Adolf Hitler. And, as we can well imagine in Israel, the course of history could well have been very different. Another example. 65 million years ago, planet Earth is, at that time, the domain of a large reptilian species, dinosaurs, and an asteroid, probably a couple of kilometers wide, comes hurtling towards our planet and impacts, people believe, probably in the Yucatan Peninsula in Mexico, causing an immense conflagration, effectively equivalent to hundreds of nuclear weapons all going off at once at one place, creating conditions on Earth that were covered with dust thrown up by this, by heat. All of the cycles of the seasons were interrupted, and the conditions on Earth no longer were able to sustain many of the life forms that thrived on the planet at that time. And in particular, the most dominant species, the dinosaurs, did not survive. They could no longer inhabit such a devastated planet. And so they died out, it seems, very quickly. This is at least the current theory, but it seems to be fairly widely accepted now. At any case, something happened that suddenly there were no more dinosaurs. That opened up an opportunity for little, they were probably like little rat rodent creatures who were mammals, who suddenly found that it was party time. They had no competition. The world was their proverbial oyster. And they flourished and they multiplied, and they slowly over the next millions of years evolved into the different forms of mammalian life, including the phylum of primates that eventually became us. Now, what if that asteroid had missed? What if it had, instead of hitting planet Earth, it had missed it by a couple of hundred miles? Would human beings have ever evolved? Would any of us have been here? Not just me, but all of us. In other words, are human beings necessary? Could it be that this world that we now live on could have never known such a form of life as us? Is this very species, therefore, contingent, dependent upon what, to all extents and purposes, are almost random events? This doesn't mean they were without causes. It is probably, you know, mathematically possible, in theory at least, to have predicted the impact of such an asteroid. But in practice, something probably we can never do. The more I think about these kinds of things, the more strange and mysterious and improbable does it appear that this life on earth is. That this human organism, which in the current form we have, is a very, very, very recent arrival on this earth. It's estimated that human beings, anatomically identical to you and me, probably first appeared only 100, 150, maybe 200,000 years ago. That's nothing. And now, of course, we're only too aware of our biological success, which has been achieved at the cost of the despoilation of many parts of the world. And now, increasingly, we are recognizing that if we don't stop our pollution, which is driven by our insatiable patterns and habits of consumption, and is protected, so we feel, by increasingly destructive weapons that we see as guarding our sovereignty and our right to our rule over a particular patch of earth, that this species may destroy itself. It may destroy many other species with it. And yet, I don't know about you, but I have this kind of strange, instinctive feeling that we are here to stay. And in particular, I am here to stay. Hopefully for a long time. I know, of course, intellectually that I'm going to die at some point, but in terms of my emotions and feelings, I always sort of keep that at a safe, not next week kind of feeling. Maybe in a few years' time or whatever. But the conviction I have of my own permanence, the conviction I have of the permanence and the almost unimaginability of human beings not existing is extremely persistent. It feels that this is the way the world is, and it's somehow right that it should be this way. It should be this way. It must be this way. But no, it doesn't have to be, and it need not have been. Just to think about the whole emergence of this universe at all, which goes back, according to current estimates, to about 15 billion years ago, starting from what is called a singularity, an extremely tiny drop of space-time that suddenly exploded and expanded into, again, the numbers are almost meaningless, 100 million galaxies. And in each galaxy, there are roughly 100 million solar systems. And then when we look inwards rather than outwards into the universe, we find in a handful of porridge-like matter in our heads an equivalent number of neurons, something as mind-bogglingly complex and diverse as the external universe beyond us. It's been calculated that the number of possible brain states, in other words, the number of configurations of neurons, axons, and so on, is greater than the number of atoms in the entire universe. Now that's a lot. And when we reflect on such things, we're pushed into, or we're invited perhaps, we are opened into a state of mind, a state of awareness that goes beyond what we can actually conceptualize. It's simply not possible for the human mind to take on board, to apprehend numbers of that magnitude, dimensions of that magnitude, a light year, the amount, the distance it takes for light traveling at 180,000 miles a second. The distance covered by light traveling at 180,000 miles a second in a year. And then we talk of hundreds of light years to measure the distances in this universe. The Romantic poets, particularly Coleridge, Keats, Wordsworth, and others, talked of this as the experience of the sublime. The sublime is characterized initially by Edmund Burke, the political and philosopher, Irish, late 18th century. The sublime is something which is both simultaneously terrifying and fascinating. And people like Coleridge in particular would seek out the experience of the sublime, usually by going into extremely wild natural places, which at his time, the Lake District in England still was. But just to enhance his sense of the sublime, Coleridge would go with a bottle of brandy in one pocket and a bottle of laudanum in the other, or in other words, a distillate of opium. And he would go into storms. He would seek to find himself in extreme conditions, such that, as Coleridge himself described it, he got to a point where the power of comparison was suspended. Coleridge's definition of the sublime, or the experience of the sublime, was the suspension of the power of comparison. In other words, of somehow being able to conceptualize things in terms of this as opposed to that, or that is greater than this. In other words, our habitual strategy of thinking, of making sense of things, of organizing things, that allows us this feeling that, okay, the world is a bit of a strange place, but I've kind of got it sorted out. We know that that's the universe and that's the brain, and okay, fine. I can now go and do something more interesting, like improve my golf handicap. What's quite extraordinary about this Big Bang is that we cannot but think of it as taking place somewhere, sometime. It happened 14 billion years ago, we say. And the human mind is almost incapable, it probably is incapable, of imagining that in fact it didn't happen anywhere. It's not as though the Big Bang actually happened there, at that little spot right there. And then kapow, the universe happened. At that moment, there was no there, and there was no then. It's meaningless to speak of what came before. There was no before. There was no there, then. That is so difficult to grasp. Our mind, and this is one of the ideas we find in the philosophy of Kant, is that we're somehow structured to perceive the world in terms of space and time. Kant thought of space and time as somehow structures of perception itself, like a kind of net that catches the world in terms of space and time. And yet, this singularity is not something that we can locate in space and time, because it was from this drop that space and time were created. Space and time were part of this creation. So it's meaningless to say what came before the Big Bang, which theistically inclined people, of course, like to attribute to God. But there was no before. It's a meaningless question. When I was a Tibetan Buddhist monk, and I trained in that tradition in the Gelug school for some 10 years or so, I remember walking one day. It was in Dharamsala, and I was living in a hut up in the forest, just on the ridge before the mountains begin. And I had to walk to a water tank to get water. And I had a blue plastic bucket. Filled the bucket up. I walked back through the forest. And then suddenly, I was overtaken by a sense of how profoundly strange it is to be here at all. A moment, I guess, somewhat comparable at a different point in my life to my adolescent confrontation with the fact that the man with the moustache and the pipe might have been my father. Later, subsequently, in reading philosophy primarily, I came across the question we find in Leibniz and then later developed by people like Heidegger. Why is there anything at all rather than nothing? And in that moment in the forest, that was, I guess, if we could put it into words, the kind of puzzlement and bewilderment that I felt. And yet, although this experience was one that was extraordinarily shocking for me, it was not something I was able to communicate to the lamas with whom I was studying. In fact, I found it impossible, even though I was learning Tibetan. I couldn't say it in Tibetan. I couldn't say what in English would be something like let's put it in this form. Why is there anything at all? Or to try to put into words the experience, life appeared to me as fundamentally a question. That life, at one level, once we again suspend the power of comparison in Coleridge's sense, appears not to us as some, you know, set of more or less intelligible facts and figures, but actually as something presenting a question. What is this, perhaps, or something like that? The questionableness, the profound questionableness of everything. And it was many years later when I decided that my training in the Tibetan tradition had somehow reached its logical conclusion, that I found myself drawn to the practice of Zen. And I traveled to South Korea, and I joined a monastery called Songwangsa. And that was a teaching and a practice that was very, very different to what I had trained in the Tibetan tradition, some of you are probably aware that in the Gelug school particularly, a great deal of emphasis is given to the study of logic and epistemology and philosophy and Buddhist doctrine. And this was enormously valuable for me. It was an extraordinary training in simply intellectual discipline. And again, we had to do all of this in Tibetan. So that somehow doubled the difficulty of some of these already difficult ideas. And yet I felt that this whole approach in some ways was taking me away from the primary puzzle that was my life. Some years before I went to Korea to train in Zen, I did a 10-day retreat with Mr. Goenka. For some reason, I never quite understood how it worked out, he came up to Dharamsala, it would have been, I think, in 1974, and he gave a 10-day course to the Tibetan monks who were studying at the dialectical school there, and any of the Western laymen, women, and monks and nuns who were studying at an institution called the Library of Tibetan Works and Archives. And there was about 40 of us, and we did this 10-day retreat. And again, that was one of those experiences that opened up the world in a way that I'd never seen it before. I'm not claiming any great spiritual insights or whatever, but simply by doing a very simple exercise, maybe some of you have done this practice, you settle the mind on the breath, and then you bring the attention to the top of your head, and you just slowly sweep down through the body to the tip of the toes, and then back to the top of the head. And you just do this for, hour upon hour upon hour. And as you do so, it somehow opens you up. It somehow breaks down certain blockages, certain constrictions that feel almost physical in a way. It was also at that time that I was first exposed to the Satipatthana Sutta in the Pali Canon, a text which has never translated into Tibetan, a text that in a way points to how the Buddha's understanding of meditation was really something so extraordinarily obvious in a way and straightforward that in some regards people might have wondered what it had to do with spiritual or religious practice at all. I'm sure particularly in the Buddha's lifetime it must have seemed very odd, where religious practice was essentially about achieving some union with God, going beyond the world of illusion, and bringing one's eternal soul, the Atman, back into union with the transcendent divine, Brahman. What the Buddha did was highly unusual. He said, and again I'm quoting more or less verbatim this text, he says, a monk goes into the forest, sits at the root of a tree, and then when he breathes in a long breath, he knows that he's breathing in a long breath. When he breathes out a long breath, he knows that he's breathing out a long breath. When he breathes in a short breath, he knows that he's breathing in a short breath. When he breathes out a short breath, and I'm sure those of you who have looked at Buddhist texts don't need to be told how mind-numbingly repetitive they can be. When you walk forward, you know that you're walking forward. When you're walking backwards, you know that you're walking backwards. When you're carrying your bowl, you know that you're carrying your bowl. When you... I think you've got the point. Now, I think this almost insistent repetition of this very single point is to hammer home that his understanding of what in Indian tradition would be called moksha or liberation is not found by seeking some transcendent reality that is beyond the illusory veil of the phenomenal world, Maya. Nor is it found by looking deep, deep inside till you touch upon some unconditioned consciousness or awareness or something. But rather, you attend to the sensory experience in all of its apparent mundaneness. You notice and you pay attention to and you feel and you sense the reality that is your life as it rises and it vanishes, as it comes and it goes. And in Goenka's approach, this is achieved by this process of sweeping through the body and the mind. And that what liberates is being able to open yourself to this phenomenality. In other words, the actual sensory presence of what's happening in this very moment. You don't have to look any further than that. But what you feel now on your bottom, the floor or a cushion or a chair, what you feel against your skin, maybe a warm air, you might have a slight discomfort in your lower back, you might have a stiff shoulder, you might be experiencing a wonderful sense of calm and serenity, or you might feel anxious or upset. Whatever it is, that is what you open yourself to. That is what you attend to. That is what you look deeply into. In the Zen tradition, in Korea, in which I spent a number of years, all we did was ask ourselves the question, what is this? And we would do this for 3 months in the summer and 3 months in the winter, 10 to 12 hours a day, in a room with a very, very white walls, yellow ochreish floor. We didn't have windows. We had lattice wooden doors with rice paper. Couldn't see out. 50 minutes sitting. What is this? 10 minutes walking, 50 minutes sitting. Now, one might be forgiven for thinking that this might be a rather boring thing to do. But on the contrary, I think I probably found it one of the most fascinating and absorbing exercises that I've ever been engaged in. And again, what I found of value in the Zen practice was that it put the emphasis not on becoming a conversant or some kind of expert in Buddhist doctrine, but rather regaining that primary contact with the very mystery of what it is to be here. To open that up in a very deliberate way as a question, as questionable, to the point that although you ask this as a form of words, inevitably the mind tries to come up with some suitably enigmatic Zen answer. But at a certain point, that habit just burns out. The question is essentially an impossible question. What is valued is bringing that quality of perplexity into your consciousness of the everyday, so that your sense of the world becomes increasingly one of the world being a very, very weird and strange place to be. A place that we won't be for very long. As we know, we could, or any of us could be dead tomorrow. And this questioning also is something that is engaged with the entire body. There's a famous passage in the commentary to a text called The Gateless Gate, where the author says, "You must question with the marrow of your bones and with the pores of your skin." Again, doesn't make an awful lot of sense, but we probably have a feeling of what that means. Now, this is very much going against the strategy of religious behavior, which I mean a form of behavior that is based upon certain beliefs. If you are a Buddhist, you are expected to believe in certain things. You believe in reincarnation and karma and the different aspects of the path and enlightenment, and every school has its own particular set of beliefs. And a belief of a religious nature is, in some regards, an answer. It's an answer to the questions that life poses to you. What is life all about? Ah, well, says the Buddha, or his latter-day representatives, the purpose of life is to become enlightened, and thereby you free yourself from suffering, and you can become a bodhisattva or an arhant, and then you can do good in the world, and that's what life is all about. If you're a Christian or a Jew or a Muslim, you've got a different set of answers, basically. But what is common to all these traditions, what is the deep common root, is not so much some speculation that they might all go to the same place, but more importantly, I feel, that they all come from the same place. They come from the fact that we have been born and that we will die. And that is a very, very odd thing to be in. In other words, and in Chinese they phrase it as simply, the great matter of birth and death. By adopting a set of answers or a set of beliefs that can certainly give you a very useful framework in which to conduct your life ethically and philosophically, doctrinally, it, for someone who's come out of a very confused and meaningless or sort of unfocused life, this is really rather like a lifeboat, something that can enable you to flourish. But at some point, it seems, the lifeboat, or perhaps the crutches might be a better example, at some point you need to let go of those crutches. Otherwise, there's the danger that religion, which is meant to provide us with means whereby to confront the deep mysteries of life, becomes a way, in fact, of suppressing them. That very often people find themselves in India or wherever it might be, they meet a great teacher, a monk or a nun, they feel a wonderful sense of homecoming. At last, I found someone who speaks sense. And that can be an enormous relief, but it always risks the danger of crystallizing into a set of rigid beliefs to which we become, as we see in the world of religious people, rather attached. We become convinced that this is the truth. And the other guys are the people who don't have it. And there's an extraordinary extent to which Buddhist, even just amongst Buddhists, let alone amongst the different religions of the world, as they become more and more orthodox and more convinced of their own rightness, the more they close themselves off from other forms of Buddhism even. I'll tell you a little story. I used to be an interpreter for a Tibetan Lama in Hamburg in Germany, and my job really was to, to translate his talks and to translate for people who came to him with questions and have interviews and so on. And one day I got a phone call from a lady who said, "Oh, I'm so glad I've got you. I've been reading the Tibetan Book of the Dead. And I found this the most amazing piece of writing, and I would love to know more about Tibetan Buddhism. And could I possibly come and speak to your Lama about this?" And of course I said, "Fine." And I set up an appointment, and the lady came, and she was brought into the room of the Geshe. This was a Gelug center. And she told the Geshe, "I've been reading the Tibetan Book of the Dead, and this has moved me very deeply, and I would very much appreciate if you could offer me some further instruction," which of course he did. And she was happy, and she went out of the room. And then the Lama turned to me, and he said, "What's this Tibetan Book of the Dead?" Now, this was a man who was not uneducated. He was a highly learned man. But he'd been raised within his particular school in Tibet. And he'd never come across this text, which actually is only used in the Nyingma school of Tibetan Buddhism, not the Gelugpa. And of course, I translated it. I didn't literally translate Tibetan Book of the Dead. I said the Bardo Tudro, which is the Tibetan name of it. Again, that was one of those moments which suddenly I became aware of something that I kind of assumed not to be the case. And I think this is characteristic of the religious mind that is invested deeply in a particular orthodoxy. Is it a kind of closure, a kind of a closing down? I would hope, and I feel there are signs of this in our world today, that those kinds of barriers are breaking down. But I think we have an awful long way to go. And perhaps the way in which we can return to our common ground, those of us who consider ourselves following a path, be it a Buddhist path or some other, to perhaps consider that what unites us are the questions that move us to engage in such practices. To allow a kind of culture to emerge in which we are able somehow to celebrate together the common mystery of our human beingness, our humanity, our sentient beingness, as the Buddhists might say. My own sense of where I'm going with Buddhism is more and more, though, towards an idea in which I feel a lot of the religiosity, which I mean both the both the forms of religious ceremonial and so forth and so on, but also the apparent need to believe in certain metaphysical views, that these things I feel more and more get in the way. And they belong very often to periods of time which are so remote from ours that they become increasingly irrelevant, and they become increasingly difficult to square with the way we understand the world today. To be quite honest, I find on reading a book on popular science, I'm not a scientist, but I do read books on cosmology and biology and physics and so forth and so on, that in the best of these books, those that are also written with a kind of a language that is not dry, but at least trying to suggest the poetry of this vision, that I am more deeply moved. My mind comes more to a stop on reading about or thinking about evolution by natural selection over all of these millions of years, or the extent to which the universe extends and goes out, or even something like the understanding we have of a single cell, that it's this sense of the world that evokes in me feelings that I would call religious or perhaps sublime. But religious is a word I'm quite happy with, far more than reading religious texts. I do spend a lot of time reading religious texts. That's my business. But in many ways, I find the usefulness of religious texts is not at all in their descriptions of what the world is and how it came to be the way it is, but rather in the methodologies, in the forms of meditation practice that I've been recounting this evening. How to refine the mind through the discipline, say, of a single-pointed concentration, or the discipline of paying mindful attention, or the discipline of pursuing a certain philosophical line of inquiry. That, I feel, is the great value of these, particularly these Buddhist texts. But when it comes, for example, to pre-modern explanations of how the world is the way it is. In Buddhism, that would be very much in the doctrine of karma. In Christianity or Judaism, Islam, it would be the doctrine of God. And remember, in many ways, the Hindu-Buddhist idea of karma functions pretty much in the same way as the theistic concept of God does. I'll give you an example. Let's say you give birth to a child with, say, Down syndrome or spina bifida. A Buddhist will somehow make sense of this experience, this crisis, this difficulty, by saying, well, it's because of the actions committed by this being in a former life. A Christian, a Muslim perhaps, a Jew, would say, well, this is the will of God. It's not something that I can ever understand. In the same way that a Buddhist will never understand the law of karma. Both of these forms of explanation function primarily as systems of consolation. They provide us with a language in which to be able to rationalize something that is, I feel, beyond the range of rationalization. If there is to be an explanation, I feel we need to seek it in our understanding of genetics, in our understanding of the human organism. We would look to science for that today, not to some pre-scientific metaphysics, be it Buddhist or Christian or Hindu or Muslim or whatever. Somehow I feel religious practice, spiritual practice, needs to free itself from its attachment to these pre-modern schemes of interpretation. To recognize that there is no outside, there is no God, there is no spirit, some preordained system of meaning, some divine plan, that this is something that is no longer, I think, very helpful. That we confront our existence and open to it as the very mystery that it is. We allow it to surprise us, both in sometimes in a way that can be very painful, at other times in a way that could be almost ecstatic. My own sense of Buddhism that I would seek to, that I'm seeking somehow to define, is a Buddhism that one might call agnostic. In other words, being able to say, I don't know. I don't know how these things came to be. I don't know what happens after death. To me, there's a greater honesty, which surely is likewise a quality of truth, rather than holding on to a belief that we are the way we are because of karma or God, and after death we'll continue on to heaven, or we'll go round in samsara one more time, or a million more times. Any conception we have of what will happen after death is a way of actually denying the mystery of death. It's rendering it basically into a manageable concept. Even if we believe, because of the terrible things we've done in this life, that we're going to go and be reborn in hell, that's far more comforting than to face death with a mind that says, I've no idea at all what this is about. To have a totally open mind in which death, rather than having been solved by the imposition of a religious belief, becomes perhaps the greatest mystery that our life affords us. This unstoppable movement towards our own end, and the, as it were, the running out of our lives, which we can also think of as a giving away of our lives in each moment. To be able to be with that without recourse to any metaphysics, to any grand theories, that for me is where I feel the most alive and the most true to myself, and I feel also true to the spirit of, in my case, the Buddha's teaching. And I've run out of things to say. We still have we still have about half an hour, so I'd be very happy to respond to any comments or questions that anyone might have.
How is it that you, rather than reaching the conclusion that basically the answer is nothing? Nothing happens after me. There is nothing. How is it that you did reach, you have this sense of the great mystery of not knowing?
Did you hear the question at the back?
No.
Okay, the question is, how come I didn't arrive at the conclusion that there is nothing after death? You see, that conclusion to me would have just been another concept. It would have also been a kind of consolation. It would have been another way of actually denying death. It's just as dogmatic, I feel, for an atheist to say death is the end, nothing after it, as it is for a religious believer to say after death you will be reborn or whatever it is. In both cases, you are overlaying death with a human idea. In this case, the idea of nothing. But death, it seems to me, as does life, is not is not contained. Life and death are not reducible to any concept. Questioning, or the note was what I've been calling mystery, keeping an open mind, agnosis. Agnostic means not knowing. Now, often in our common usage of the word agnostic, a person will say, well, I'm actually agnostic, which usually means I don't really care too much about those kinds of questions. I don't know. For me, agnosticism is a deep agnosticism. For me, this not knowing is not just an arbitrary choice I choose to make to define myself in some way, but is actually deep at the heart of the whole quest for truth, meaning, whatever you call it. If you think about it, when you ask a question, like, for example, well, a trivial question, which is the road to Haifa? As soon as you ask that question, you are implicitly saying, I don't know where the road to Haifa is. In other words, every question is the giving voice to a not knowing, an unknown. So when we ask a question in Zen, like, what is this? Or in some of the traditions, who am I? At the same time, you are acknowledging to yourself, and I would say, when this is done in meditation, at a visceral level, at a level you feel in your body, you're acknowledging the fact that you don't know. That you've got to a point in your life where any explanation has somehow failed. And you are confronted with the sheer mystery, for lack of a better word, of what is. So that's the reason I didn't... I don't find the answer of nothing any more compelling than the answer of something. Yes?
I wanted to ask about constellation. It seems to me that there's a slight ambivalence in your move from saying that the traditional religious views are in the business of giving constellation, whereas science is a much better storyteller, for lack of a better word, but they're playing radically different games.
That's correct.
And so, on the one hand, it seems to me that one of the advantages of Buddhism, among other things, is its lack of consolation, its lack of willingness to tell a greater story other than primarily the practice of meditation, although they, of course, do. But it seems that that's the leftover from the Hindu tradition, in my mind.
Okay. I think we get a somewhat distorted impression of Buddhism sometimes, because it's often comes presented to us as you very clearly say, as it's a form of meditation practice. It's a form of spiritual discipline. That's also that's I think probably for most of us is what attracts us to it. It's something to do. It's not something to believe. But I suspect that the vast majority of Buddhists in the world today and throughout the history of Buddhism have actually found solace and consolation in Buddhism more than anything else. And I don't want to be elitist about this. It's very easy to somehow be slightly dismissive. Or you're only a sort of... You're only looking to have a better rebirth. I think for many people, that's an important thing. I don't want to make a mass judgment. I'm trying to make this as autobiographical as possible. I personally don't feel that Buddhism essentially is in the business of consolation. I agree with you. When you read the early texts or the suttas or any kind of primary text within any Buddhist tradition, That's clearly not the point. But nonetheless, Buddhism is not just a set of spiritual exercises. It's also a culture, it's a civilization, it has a social function, and in that sense, it's much like most religions. And it may be the case when, for example, in a tradition like Vipassana or Zen, then, you know, it is pretty much pared down just to the discipline of meditation. But if you go to a Zen monastery in Japan, for example, or a Zen temple in Japan, you'll find that the priest spends most of his time going to the houses of his different parishioners and reciting prayers. He may not do any meditation at all. Buddhism functions in most Buddhist societies much in the same way as Christianity or other religions would function in our cultures. So we're kind of getting, I think, a somewhat distorted picture. Some Buddhist traditions, I think particularly the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, which in some respects is much more comprehensive than Zen or Vipassana, it takes on board a much wider vision of what human life is and gives much more importance to the bigger picture. There you do, I think, have rather explicitly the idea that the most important thing is not so much what you do in this life, but how you prepare yourself for the many lives to come. So you do find that. It's not consolatory, strictly speaking. It's inspirational. You are aspiring to become a Buddha for the sake of all beings. But there's a phrase of Sakya Pandita that I always remember. It says, Tsedi la shemba chiba min. If you are someone who's only concerned with this life, you are not a practitioner of the Dharma. Now, I can't accept that. For me, this life is, as far as I know, all there is. This life is itself so profoundly mysterious, so profoundly perplexing. And when we look, and again, here I will appeal to the science. I don't look for science to tell me what to do. It's not in that business. It's not playing that game, as you say.
It's descriptive.
It's descriptive, exactly. So when I look at the scientific description of the human organism, how it came to be, how the universe came to be, I don't see any room, frankly, for some spiritual X factor that will escape the body at death and move on somewhere else. I don't see any evidence of other worlds, of other realms at all. And when we, if we consider our life on this planet, and I think one of the great spiritual impacts that the scientific world has had upon us is to show the Earth from outer space, to suddenly see a photograph of this blue globe spinning around the sun, and in a vast emptiness, which really has no interest in us. It throws us into a description of the world that I don't find disheartening. I don't find somehow devoid of value and meaning. I find it actually inspires within me a deep sense of the preciousness of this life. One of my main objections to the idea of karma and rebirth particularly is that it always gives us an opt-out clause for engaging ourselves totally with this world. So that in some respects, even if the world went up in a nuclear holocaust, even if we destroy the planet and all beings die, from a multi-life rebirth perspective, it doesn't really matter. Every being on Earth will then go and get reborn somewhere else. I think as long as you have that opt-out, I think it's difficult to engage your wisdom and your compassion unconditionally and totally with the only thing we know for certain, and that is there are living beings on this planet. That's all we know. And I feel that the religions of the world need to take that as their primary concern, not what might happen in some hypothetical afterlife. Yes? And then here. Yes? You?
Can you then redefine by your system or by your belief the meaning objects of knowledge, the term objects of knowledge?
Objects of knowledge?
Yes.
In what context exactly?
In context of, is there anything to know at all?
Yes, I would say so. To me, the primary object of knowledge, and I'll put this in my Buddhist jargon, is what the Buddha called paticca-samuppada, dependent arising, dependent origination, contingency, as I called it. That, I feel, is the thing we need to truly pay a great deal of attention to. And that is an object of knowledge. That is something that we can know. And through the, we can know it empirically, we can know it rationally, but most importantly, we can come to know it intuitively, in a felt sense. That's what matters. That it's not any longer just a theory we hold or a belief we hold, but it's something almost like a kind of a felt resonance within our body-mind organism. What Buddhism presents is actually quite a developed epistemology, in other words, a theory of knowledge, which starts with, as it were, acquiring certain pieces of information, then thinking about them, and then realizing them through meditation and other disciplines in an intuitive way. The Buddha himself presented a threefold scheme of the cultivation of intelligence. Usually this word is translated as wisdom, prajna, panya, but actually it really means intelligence. He talked about intelligence that comes from acquiring information, intelligence that comes from thinking about the information that one has acquired, in other words, by thinking about it, integrating it into your worldview, and then bhavanamaya panya, intelligence that comes through actually bringing that idea into felt experience such that it's something you know almost viscerally.
Which is to meditate.
Meditation is one way of doing it. I don't think one wants to, you know, to somehow isolate meditation as a means of knowing. I think also it can be often in moments in which we're not meditating.
Spontaneously.
Like some of the experiences I recounted in my own story. These were not things that came from meditation. You know, take for example Huineng, the sixth patriarch of the Zen tradition, a young peasant boy, goes out into the forest with his granny, his grandmother, to collect firewood. Walking back from the forest with the firewood on his back, there's a monk sitting on the side of the road, reciting the Diamond Sutra. And as they walk past the monk, they hear the words, "Where the mind has nowhere to rest." Bang. Huineng gets it. Now, there's no meditation involved here. There's a certain openness to what the world reveals to us.
So you just sit on a bump and wait that dependently arising thing just pop into your head. Yeah, that then we'll spontaneously understand it.
Unfortunately, I don't think it's quite as simple as that. Because the Buddha diagnoses the problematic of human life. In other words, why is it that we are so stupid? Why is it that we cause ourselves so much grief? It's because we've effectively adopted a strategy, and I suspect this actually has its origins in survival strategies, of somehow closing ourselves down to the contingency of life. And that's what I was trying to get at the beginning of this talk. This conviction that we're necessary. This conviction that I have to be here. That is not something we just think about. It's almost an instinctive, a certainty That's what gets in our way. And so meditation is not just about meditating on dependent origination. It's also about somehow loosening and breaking down our resistance to dependent origination, to contingency. So meditation is a discipline that certainly requires paying attention, inquiring, but it also requires a deepening of our very capacity to be present. So technically they talk about shamatha and vipassana, stilling the mind and then looking deeply. So to really get dependent origination, we need to somehow deconstruct or let fall away within ourselves though that deep instinct that denies dependent origination.
I don't fully understand the English word dependent origination. I understand it more separately.
Okay.
Or contingency, if you can understand.
I'm sorry. The question has to do with could I please define dependent origination, contingency? I have to confess, this is Buddhist jargon. In other words, it's a technical language used by Buddhists. When the Buddha came to, when he was asked, what is dependent arising? Paticca sammuppada. It is difficult to try. Even in English, it sounds very weird, really. It's not, if I told my mother, I just had a wonderful experience of dependent origination, she would say, what are you talking about, dear? One of the ways the Buddha described it, he said, when this is, that arises. When it's basically, we might simply call it causality. It's cause and effect. That when certain conditions are in place, something will happen. When other conditions are in place, something else will happen. It's recognizing that nothing exists intrinsically, in and of itself. But everything that occurs to us, everything that we experience, has come about through circumstances, conditions, causes that have brought it into being.
Including us.
Oh yes, definitely including us.
But that's what, when you said that experiencing this contingency is, did you mean that we experience the fact that we are just something
that's right. In experiencing, I like the word contingency, but let's just stick with dependent origination. In experience oneself as dependently arising, we are suddenly shocked into the fact that we need not have existed. And that's why I gave the example of my mother and all this stuff, because I personally find that those kinds of reflections make that point more vividly. They did to me, rather than this rather dry Buddhist sort of doctrine and analysis. Yes.
I think pretty much it's taught that we take for granted the ideas of karma and reincarnation as the Buddha's world, because we study these first things and then we check it for ourselves and we say, yeah, the suffering. So we take for granted the next points. Mm. So there's all of this, and it's just the Buddha's experience. So if we go inside and check ourselves and questions, we get somewhere else, or we get to the same point about reincarnation and karma and everything. After we check suffering. And
right. Did you hear that?
No.
The question has to do that, you know, we somehow take it for granted, and I mean we, meaning Buddhists, I guess, that there is karma in reincarnation. Because we, for example, are taught about the nature of suffering, that we find relatively intelligible. And if we were to continue our inquiry, our investigation, would we also come to that same understanding, the Buddha's experience of karma and reincarnation? Or would we come to something else? Was that the question? Yeah. I actually had no difficulty with the fact that the Buddha did believe in karma and reincarnation. This, I think, was his worldview, which he shared with pretty much everybody else of his time. What I find useful here is to try and, it's very difficult to do this, to try and imagine oneself back in the world of 500 BC India, forgetting everything that we've known about everything since then. The world of the Buddha was one very much informed by the vision of the Upanishads. In other words, the idea that spiritual salvation is achieved through breaking free of the cycle of birth and death, which is driven by karma. This is not a Buddhist idea. The Buddha did not come up with that theory. That theory was already in place at the Buddha's time. It's certainly true that Buddhist philosophers and thinkers developed this in very sophisticated ways. But the basic paradigm was a given at that period in India. And I think it's very similar to the way for us today, when I tell you that that story of the universe arising, we take that for granted. It's something we would not actually question. That is the given paradigm within which we understand the world and our place in it today. It's only when you meet someone who doesn't believe it that you realize, in fact, it's just a belief. I've actually had long arguments with some of my Tibetan Lama friends about trying to convince them that the world is not, in fact, flat, but it's round. And it exposes to me how I'm actually, you know, in a way, just, I've just accepted that as a belief. I can't prove it. I can't demonstrate it. I've told you about how we arise through, you know, random mutation of natural selection, and we all sort of nod, oh yeah, sure. But epistemologically, that is just something we've taken on hearsay, on the authority of scientists. We don't know it. It's not an object of our knowledge at all. I can talk of quarks and electrons and molecules and proteins. I've got absolutely no experience of those things whatsoever. Now, I think I think that is a given within any human epoch, within any human society, that there's a certain set of a priori views of the world that are just taken for granted. Now, when we shift from one set of a priori views into a very different kind of world, then we have to, or we find ourselves questioning, well, is karma and rebirth intrinsic to Buddhism, or is it simply a relic, a leftover of the worldview that he inhabited? I would look at it that way. And for that reason, I don't feel any hesitation in letting it go. But again, as the Buddhists would tell you, check it out. Yes.
Your Lama friend, they think of you as a Buddhist?
Probably not. My Lama friends think of me as a Buddhist. I have somewhat ambivalent relationship, and I do sometimes go back and see my Tibetan Lama friends, and we have a very warm connection. They're my friends. I've spent many of my formative years with these men. Really, perhaps some of the richest years of my life. I've translated texts from Tibetan. You know, I've written a guidebook to Tibet. I've done a lot of work in a way to make Tibetan Buddhism better known. But I do think they find it very hard to understand why, with all the studies that I've done, and they probably don't think that I'm entirely stupid, that I would come up with some of the things I said. And I find that painful, actually. Who are they? I mean, it's for me, the Buddhist path, or any path really, is something that has to have integrity. I'm not prepared to simply present Buddhist doctrines as though they are true unless I'm convinced of that myself. I think Buddhism is a very wide church, one might say. And one has to remember that most of my Tibetan lamas consider Zen Buddhism as a heresy. It's not really Buddhism either. And many forms, like Nichiren Buddhism, they would probably find totally incomprehensible. And vice versa. I remember once, when I was in Korea, talking to some Korean monks once, I told them that I'd been a Tibetan Buddhist, and they said, "Oh, the Tibetans, they're just a bunch of shamans, or shamans." And then a few months later, I went back to see my teacher, Geshe Rabtin, and he was, I said, "You know, I've been studying with these Korean lamas, Korean monks." And he said, "Oh, the Koreans, they're just a bunch of shamans." And in other words, I think that's, to me, very... and it comes back to the other story I told. There's not a great deal of mutual comprehension amongst the different Buddhist groups. But nowadays, we don't have the luxury of geographical isolation. And we find suddenly ourselves confronting one another. I mean, even in Israel, here in Tel Aviv, probably within half an hour, you can be in a Tibetan Buddhist group or a Zen group or the Vipassana group or many different variants of all of them. They're all present. And this is historically something entirely unprecedented and unique. We cannot but be aware of Buddhism as a plural phenomenon. It's a plurality. It's a diversity. And therein lies its richness for me. And I think it's very sad when sectarianism gets in the way, either overtly or covertly. The sort of subtle suggestion that, you know, those guys, well, you know, they're very good people, but...
Where is the compassion?
I think there can be compassion in that, but not understanding. And perhaps for compassion to really take place, there does also need to be understanding. And I hope that our modern world, our incredibly mixed up and confusing modern world, can also be a place where people who have ignored each other for hundreds of years can start to know each other. I think that's important, and I think that will be a great source of vitality, not only to the different Buddhist traditions, but hopefully to the other religions of the world as well. We can't afford anymore to live in isolation from one another. There's too much at stake. And we see it now in the, you know, the squabbles between the Abrahamic families, the Christians and the Jews and the Arabs, the Muslims. From a Buddhist point of view, this looks like a family argument. But unfortunately, it is holding the world to ransom. We have to go beyond that. Otherwise, I think the dangers are considerable. And it's 10 o'clock. Thank you very much. And could I just once more remind you that whatever you feel moved to put into the box on the table over there will go towards the work of Tovana. Thank you very much for patiently listening to me. If you want any further information about the work of my wife and myself, you can go to www.stephenbatchelor.com. .org, or you can just Google me. Thank you.